The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover...
Inside the house, there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, the Hargan family killings, wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit amazon.com/prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
The following episode contains adult subject matter, including sensitive material, and is intended for adult consumption only. It may not be suitable for all audiences. Therefore, discretion is advised. Opinions expressed by the subjects interviewed for this podcast are not representative of the producers of the series. Previously on Son of a Hitman. What do you know about what we're doing so far?
Well, I understand we're going to investigate probability of my father being involved in a couple different assassinations.
He was an outright psychopath. We had more female witnesses that had slept with him than we could shake a stick at.
This was the largest investigation that the FBI has ever run outside of the Kennedy one. Somebody had to go down for it.
What do you think the chances are that Charles Harrelson killed the judge?
I don't give it more than a 20% chance that he actually did it.
What are you hoping for?
A fair trial, right? A fair trial, that's all that he's ever wanted. That's all we've ever wanted.
I wish I could know all he has done.
It's 1968, and a group of guys are drinking and playing cards in a seedy Texas bar called Lucky Pierre's. According to the book Run, Brother, Run, one of the guys, a 5'2 Italian named Frank DiMaria, is ranting about some prick, a rival carpet salesman, who cost him thousands of dollars. DiMaria allegedly says, "I'd like to murder the bastard." At this, a business card gets thrown onto the table.
He hands me his business card.
And he handed me a card.
I mean, he was a nice guy when you met him, but I remember he gave me his card.
The card reads, "Wars fought, revolutions started, assassinations plotted, governments run, uprisings quelled, women seduced, tigers tamed, bars emptied, computers verified, orgies organized, used cars, land, beer, manure, nails, fly swatters, racing forms, bongos, pool, dry holes, sports cars, setups, broads, bets. And one more thing that I'm not going to say."
And the card said, "Hired killer.
Murder for hire. Shot free."
This business card belongs to none other than Charles V. Harrelson.
He was a handsome guy.
He had a very arrogant air about him.
Harrelson was a lowlife. He was a snitch.
He was a cocaine junkie.
He loved guns.
Piece of shit dude who would do anything for money.
He could just kill you and he wouldn't care.
Son of a Hitman, Chapter 2. Everybody liked Charlie.
Are you all packed up?
I'm all packed up, I think so.
You ready to be alone with your thoughts on all this for 2 weeks?
I think so. In a hotel
alone in Texas?
At least it's a lot of different hotels.
It's basically 2 weeks of alone time with Charles Harrelson.
My bags are packed, and I'm about to make the journey to the Lone Star State to see what I can uncover about the hitman, Charles Harrelson. My girlfriend Phoenix is helping me prepare.
You're definitely gonna feel different than you do right now.
I think it's gonna feel a little bit more real.
At this point, I know Harrelson was charged with three murders, The first was the kidnapping and brutal killing of a Houston man named Alan Berg. The second was the execution of a grain dealer named Sam DeGelia. And most famously, the third was the assassination of federal judge John Wood. I'm going to follow Harrelson's trail across Texas, one murder at a time. I'm going to visit the scenes of the crimes, speak to the family members of the dead, and cross-examine the witnesses to learn whether Charles Harrelson was just a con man who ran his mouth or a deadly hitman.
You're going to be going to the place where it happened. Well, I won't say anything, but you better tell me where your location is.
I'm a little paranoid going into this.
Each and every one of you, 976 miles to the west of the valley.
I saw that Woody Harrelson is actually hosting Saturday Night Live this weekend, which is sort of ironic. As I kick off this trip, begin chasing after his dad, he's sort of right in the spotlight.
All right, here we are.
My first stop in Texas is to meet with my private investigator, Brad Thompson, who's helping me track down background information on Harrelson and some of the harder-to-find sources who knew him back when.
Hey.
How you doing, Brad
Jason.
Thompson?
Nice to meet you.
You too.
Before I get into his first murder, I want to understand who Charles Harrelson really was and how he might have become a hitman in the first place. So Brad and I are driving a couple hours southeast of Fort Worth to Lovelady, Texas, the place where Charles was born and raised.
Yeah. Oh, wow, yeah. Some green rolling hills.
Mm-hmm. Back in its heyday when the Klan was still the big thing, these areas down here in southeast Texas, that was their place.
Lovelady feels like a place that time forgot. One-story houses and double-wide trailers are scattered here and there on grassy fields. We pull up to one of the one-story homes to meet with Maydeen Harrelson.
Hello, Miss Maydeen. Brad Thompson, those are for you.
Wow. If you all would, just go in there and have a seat.
All right.
Thank you. Would you want to sit on the porch?
Over 60 years have passed since Charles Harrelson left this place. And Maydeen, a cousin of Charles, is one of the few relatives who's still around. I want to see what, if anything, she can remember about Charles as a boy.
Peaceful out here.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it's everybody thinks it's too quiet, but I don't.
That's beautiful.
And you said there's quite a few of the Harrelsons living just right here.
These are all Harrelsons. That's a grandson, and a grandson lives down there. Debbie lives right up the road across, and this is cousins over here, and my brother-in-law lives there.
Is there anybody in town that was one of those people who just knew everything and everybody?
They've all died. I'm trying to think if there's anybody around here older than I am.
Really?
Bill and I were about the oldest people left.
Did your husband know Charles back then?
My husband drove the bus from the time he was about 18 years old. And I know he never caused Dale any trouble on the school bus.
Did your husband stay in touch with Charlie?
No, I don't think he did. But his daddy still lived here.
What was his father like?
He was a very unique person. I don't know how else to say. He could work math in his head quicker than you could do it on an ad machine. But Mr. Harrelson would gather everybody's cows up that wanted to sell them and take a load down in Houston every now and then. But that was the only choice you had then.
Was his mom around or was...
No, his mother must have been dead from years back. I don't know. But I know I never remember a mother. Mm-hmm. He had a brother and he had a sister, and I'm not sure where she lived.
It's worth noting, Charles's son Brett told me some things about his uncle Claude. Talk to me about your dad's relationship with his brother, from what you know.
Well, he didn't like him at all because he was a cop. There's nobody he hates more in the world than law enforcement. because look at his whole life. They were the sworn enemy. And I know that when Claude was doing a security detail transporting a prisoner, and the prisoner confiscated his gun and shot and killed him. When Charles heard that news, it was awesome, perfect. He hated his brother. They never spoke. Claude was scared of Charles, that, you know, if he got out, would he come kill him?
Claude wasn't the only Harrelson who worked in law enforcement. In this area of East Texas, one of the only industries besides ranching was the local prison, Eastham, a place where Charles did some time and a lot of his family members worked. He spoke about this once in an interview.
Several members of my family were in law enforcement, and I really don't know where they went wrong, but I don't hold it against them.
Well, I'll tell you, the inmates down at Eastham thought very highly of Charlie. When I went down there to teach, I was always amazed. I mean, those inmates came from everywhere just to ask me how he was doing.
Wow. He was like a celebrity in there, huh?
He really was.
Did Charlie get into trouble when he was a kid or not so much?
I don't think so. I never did hear of any trouble that he got into. I don't really remember him getting into trouble down there until the carpet man.
When Mae Dean says Charlie had some trouble with the carpet man, she's actually referring to more than just a little trouble. She's talking about the first murder that Charles Harrelson was charged with, shooting and strangling a carpet salesman, Alan Berg.
But now I'm telling you, Charlie got along with everybody. Everybody seemed to like Charlie.
After talking to Mae Dean, some of Charles Harrelson's early life is coming into focus. I learned he grew up without a mother, which had to have some impact on his childhood. And his dad was intelligent and ran a ranch. So I imagine Charles had to do some hard labor when he was a kid. And a whole lot of his family worked in law enforcement. Given all this information, it's interesting to see he ended up on the other side of the law. With my PI Brad's help, we've done a deep dive into public records on Charles Harrelson. But at this point, the man remains a bit of a mystery. The FBI's file on Harrelson is under seal, so I've had to get creative. I was able to get a hold of the transcript from Charles Harrelson's testimony during the Judge Wood murder trial. In it, he provided a little more detail on his early years. I'll be reading the role of Charles's defense attorney, Tom Sharp. I've had Charles's son, Brett, read the part of his dad. What exactly did your family consist of?
Well, there were six children, five surviving. I am the youngest.
Where did you graduate from high school, if you did?
I did not graduate from high school.
Did you at any time complete an equivalent of your high school education?
Yes, I did in 1956 in Norfolk, Virginia in the U.S. Navy.
Did you have some military specialty in the Navy?
I was a sonar man.
How long were you in the Navy, Mr. Harrelson?
3 years and 6 months.
What rank did you attain?
Petty officer, third class.
Were you married then at the time?
Yes, I was married then.
Okay, what's your wife's name?
Diane.
Charles Harrelson and Diane Oswald, no relation to Lee Harvey Oswald, by the way, would go on to have 3 children. Jordan in 1960, Woody in 61, and Brett in 63, the same year John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Charles had his first run-in with the law in 1960, when he was arrested for armed robbery. He was given 5 years probation. For work during this time, Charles was supposedly employed by a dental supply company and gambling professionally. When did you first take up gambling?
I believe I was 12.
Did you consider yourself an expert when it came to dealing cards?
I'm an expert card mechanic, yes, sir. I can put any hand you want at any position you want it by simply opening up a new deck of cards and shuffling them.
This sounds like quite the card trick, and I was skeptical of this claim at first. But Charles Harrelson does seem to have some kind of understanding of gambling and cheating at cards that goes beyond the average person's.
In the case of a poker game, one of the most common ways of stealing money from some unsuspecting sucker is by using what is known as a cold deck. And if I may demonstrate,
say this deck of cards was in the game being shuffled. The cold deck would be in the person's lap, such as this. A Confederate, probably on the other side of the table, would create a diversion of some sort. Normally, it's a spilled drink or an ashtray. And when the pigeon turns his head, the man who has shuffled the cards drops the deck into his lap and comes up dealing with this deck, which is the same color. But most people who play for high stakes are smart enough, they feel a cooler. The reason a cold deck is called a cooler is because when you pick the cards up, after a deck of cards has been played with for a few minutes, the body heat from the people playing in the game will actually increase the temperature of those cards. And when a cooler is put in, the deck feels cold, and hence, cold deck. And the person who puts in the cold deck, if he's playing with someone who's smart, that person is going to suspect that he has been had. The very best that can happen is that you have to give the money back. The worst that can happen, and quite frequently does, they get killed.
After reading this testimony, I'm pretty certain Charles Harrelson was in fact a card shark. And he'll tell you that's all he was.
Are you a hitman?
I'm a card player. If you have a deck of cards, I can show you more tricks with 52 cards than a monkey can with 52 feet of grapevine, I promise you.
That may be true, but by 1968, the Texas Rangers also believed he was a killer for hire. That same year, they tracked the 30-year-old Harrelson to Atlanta, Georgia, where he was living under the pseudonym Terry Southern and was wanted for the murder of the carpet man, Alan Berg. So today, I'm headed to Houston, Texas, to meet with the victim's brother, David, to try to understand how this all came about.
I've been coming to this drugstore, the Avalon drugstore, for, 40 years.
Wow. It's cool. It feels like it could be in Yonkers.
Yeah, exactly.
There she is. Hi, Brenda.
In looking at the story of Charles Harrelson, it's tempting to focus on the sex, drugs, and violence. But I also want to make sure I'm not glorifying a convicted killer. So I want to take some time to see things from a victim's perspective.
I think Alan lived with a sense that he could never please our father. In our family, becoming a doctor was not a cute Jewish joke. My dad was obsessive about it. You know, a dad tried to live out his life through ours.
Family is such an interesting thing. The way that stuff shapes you. And the way it gets passed down the line, you know?
The great psychologist, whose name I can't remember, was asked to define family. He said, that organization designed to transmit mental illness. You ready to go?
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna take you somewhere.
David and I drive about an hour south from Houston until we reach a two-lane coastal road between Surfside and Galveston, Texas. The Gulf of Mexico on our right and overgrown marshland to the left.
I never could bring myself to come down here. Oh my God, yeah, this is where you would hide someone and you wouldn't be found.
Yeah, it's very dense.
Very dense.
Dense brush.
It's sort of pretty, but also eerie, imagining it as the place where Alan's body was dumped.
He threw my brother's sunglasses in that intercoastal waterway. There was they found him in a canal of some sort.
There's a canal right there.
Hmm. I think we're coming to the area where they ditched Alan.
David and I get out of the car in an area of thick brush. Somewhere near here, Alan's lifeless body was left.
Snakes. There'll be snakes in here.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Do you have boots on?
I have boots on.
High boots? Yeah,
yep.
High boots.
Yep, they're about up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
There was a ditch filled with water, and that's where they found Alan's skeletal remains 6 months after he was murdered.
Do you feel Alan here at all or no?
No. What I feel is just a sense of how dreadful his end was. Now look at these thick bushes. I think about how successful the murderer was. I can't imagine what the animals did to Alan, what time did, so that all that was left here were his bones. While we were driving down the road, I got the sense of what it must have been like for Alan, actually, dead in a trunk down this road with this low-life pimp, hired killer. And I can't say enough bad about him. What was my brother, this big-hearted man, what was he doing in the hands of this racist pustule of a human being? Maybe I do have a sense of what it was like for Alan, but I don't feel his presence here. I'd rather carry him with me than see him in these bushes. Oh, well, I didn't mean to get melodramatic. It's a little harder than I thought it was going to be.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. Forget dark alleys and cemeteries. For some, the gym is the scariest place of all, but it doesn't have to be. With a personalized plan and expert coaching, Anytime Fitness can help make the gym less frightening. Get more for your gym membership than machines. Get personalized support anytime, anywhere. Visit AnytimeFitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, and restrictions apply. See website for details. This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
David and I get back in the car and begin the drive back toward Houston. I think about how hard this must have been for him. As someone with siblings, the thought of losing one to murder is unimaginable. As we reach the city, David slows in front of a lone standing storefront for a carpeting business.
Yeah, this is it.
Floor isn't up. So this is Frank DeMaria, huh?
Yeah.
According to David, Frank DeMaria is the guy who hired Charles Harrelson to kill Alan Berg.
I didn't realize he was still around.
Yeah, don't go to his office. I'm told he's armed always.
So oh, really?
Yeah, be careful.
Okay.
David and I arrive back at his place, and he begins telling me the story of Alan Berg, Frank DeMaria, and Charles Harrelson. For David, the nightmare all started with a phone call from Alan's wife.
I remember exactly. Harriet called, it was 4 a.m., and she said, "Have you heard from Alan? He hasn't come home yet." And that was not my brother. I mean, he would go home every night after selling carpet out in various parts of town. And I knew at that moment, I knew that my brother was dead.
In the months leading up to Alan's death, David says he'd seen the writing on the wall.
There'd been too many warning signs. Alan had been driving home, and it was a stormy night, and somebody ran him into the bayou, and his car slid halfway down. I don't know how he managed to avoid drowning. And he was convinced that it was the Cadillac owned by this guy, Frank DeMaria.
So why did Frank DeMaria allegedly have such a vendetta against Alan Berg? I had a chance to speak to David and Alan's younger sister, Linda, and she had this to say.
Frank DeMaria was a man that my brother Alan hired to manage the store, and then they discovered that DeMaria was stealing money from the company. And Alan fired him, and DeMaria decided he wanted to go into competition with my father and Alan. And the finance company would call my father and say, this guy wants financing, should we give it to him? And my dad would just go crazy, saying, no, he's a crook, do not give him anything. I guess DeMaria decided to get even.
Once DeMaria had been crossed, Linda says there was no turning back.
I was at home alone. I heard something at the bedroom window. It was Frank DeMaria. He was just standing there looking, and it scared the bejesus out of me. There was just this short, fat son of a bitch staring at me.
There had been other warning signs. We were pulling out of the upholstery plant, and a guy comes running up to the car. He's got his hand in a sack, and it's clear he's got a gun. And he comes up screaming the car, calling Alan dirty Jews, you don't pay anybody. Wasn't the first time Alan had a gun pointed at him. And Alan sat very calmly, and he said, what are you talking about? He said, you owe me $125. And Alan said, well, let me pay you. And he said, you better, I'll blow your brains out. I remember distinctly, he writes the check, and he handed the guy the check. The guy runs away, screaming he ought to blow your brains out anyway, blah, blah, blah. And as we drive away, Alan gets about a block away, and he begins to cry. He pulls the car over, and he says, I've got to get out of this business. Alan and I sat down with Dad after all these warning signs emerged, and we asked Dad to please lay off DeMaria. Dad said, I don't give a damn what you think. You're a kid. My father reacted violently and walked out and slammed the door.
Soon after, Alan went missing, and David received the 4 a.m. phone call from Alan's wife that he hadn't come home.
The police wouldn't open an investigation because they said it's just another runaway husband. So Dad opened his own investigation, and he began spending desperately.
With his son missing and an unresponsive police department, Berg's father put up a $10,000 reward for any information regarding his son's disappearance. And every con artist in Houston came out of the woodwork to get a piece of it.
It was nightmares, hell. It was calls coming in saying he had been put through a meat grinder. Horrible things. I saw my dad just doing anything he could think of to find his son.
About midway through the summer, Dad gets a call from Claude Harrelson. He's a private investigator in Houston.
In addition to being a Houston PI, as Brett and Maydeen told me, Claude was a former cop and the older brother of Charles Harrelson.
Dad knows nothing about him, so he hires Claude Harrelson of a Friday, and on a Monday, he says, meet me at the Avalon Diner, the place where you and I had breakfast this morning. Claude Harrelson knew what happened to Alan. He said, he was murdered. I know where his body is. He said, for $3,000, I'll tell you who murdered your son, and I can find out where his body is once the money is paid. Dad arranged to have the $3,000 paid, and Dad gets a call at 3 a.m, and now the price went to $5,000. And the next time he got a call, it was $10,000 that they wanted from him, and they tell him where his boy was. I was on the phone with him when he called Claude Harrelson that Monday morning and said, we're going to the police, and you're going to tell them what you know about who killed my son, and you're going to tell them where my son's body is. And Claude Harrelson wouldn't do it.
From police records, it appears that Claude was just acting as a liaison for his brother. Charles told him he knew where Alan Berg's body was, but kept increasing his demands for money before he would tell Claude the exact location.
But the Rangers knew that Claude's brother, Charles, was a serial killer, a hitman. They told us they knew of 12 murders he had committed. They thought it was 20 or more. And we went to the police department, and they wouldn't do anything.
Without a body, police couldn't open a murder investigation. At this point, it was still just a missing person.
Finally, Dad gets a call from a man named Dennis Weedock, who told Dad that he had once worked for Dad and Alan, and he knew where Alan's body was. And for $10,000, he would tell Dad where he was. So Dad bought it. And this investigator who Dad had hired went to an area near Surfside, Texas. And he went into an incredibly overgrown area in the middle of a storm with lightning cracking around him. And they found Alan's remains.
I was a kid, and my brother was my brother, and it never dawned on me after 6 months what they would find.
That morning, I woke up to a picture on the front page of the Houston Post of a deputy holding my brother's skull.
Today, printing an image like this would never fly. The insensitivity is pretty remarkable.
And it just sent me over the edge. I'm sorry. You know, you just don't picture that. You don't think that way.
Dennis Weedock, the man who provided the tip about Alan's body, agreed to tell police what he knew in exchange for the $10,000 in reward money.
So my sister, with that horrible vision in her mind of our brother, Dad gave her $10,000 to deliver to the president of a bank, which she does, and Weedock agrees to testify. Weedock knows what happens because he's been living with a woman named Sandra Sue Attaway.
Weedock told police that Sandra Sue Attaway, Harrelson's ex-girlfriend, had witnessed the murder. Police took her in for questioning, and she told them everything. I've gotten a hold of Sandra Sue's statement to police, and I've had my associate producer, Deborah, read a portion aloud for audio purposes. I have to warn you that what we're going to be talking about in the next few minutes is disturbing and describes acts of violence in a graphic way.
About the end of April, he told me he had a job to do collecting a debt, and he wanted me to help him. I asked him about the job, and little by little, he told me that a boy named Alan Berg had cheated a man named Frank DeMaria out of $7,000, and he would get $2,000 for convincing the boy to pay it. On a Tuesday night, he came into the apartment and said he wanted me to make a phone call. He told me to talk the boy into meeting me at the Brass Jug Club. We drove around the club and saw the boy going into the club. Chuck jumped out and forced Alan to enter our car by use of a gun and a shove. He told Alan that this was a kidnapping, and Alan said that his daddy would furnish whatever money was needed. Chuck kept telling me where to turn, and we were in an area completely unfamiliar to me. He said that he was looking for a certain spot, but that it had been a long time since he had been out there and couldn't find it. Finally, he was getting more and more nervous, I could tell, and he said, "Stop right where we were." He and Alan got out of the car and he closed the door, and I could hear them walking to the back of the car. I assumed that he was going to beat on the boy, and so I didn't look because I knew what it felt like to be hit. And I was shaking inside because when he was nervous, like I could tell he was liable to do anything. Then I heard a shot.
Well, he shot Alan. It was a gunshot to the head through and through.
And she said that Harrelson started to panic a little and said he had to get some rope because Alan wasn't dead. He was making gurgly sounds. And he put a rope around his neck and he dragged him to make sure he was dead. I'm sorry.
Harrelson dragged his body and threw him in the marsh. And that's where he was for 6 full months before we found him. And we found him because Dennis Weedock lived with Sandra Sue Attaway, who told him the whole story. She says that her great regret was that she let us suffer like that for 6 months, that she didn't come forward sooner. But she did. She did let us suffer like that.
The Texas Rangers tracked Charles Harrelson to Atlanta, Georgia, where he was living under the assumed name Terry Southern. Harrelson was brought to the Brazoria County Jail in Angleton, Texas, to await trial.
So my dad had me sit through every day of the trial and report back to him.
What were your impressions of Harrelson?
Cold as ice. Cold as ice. There was nothing in his eyes. Nothing. Just, like, I don't even know how to describe it. Just nothing there.
What were your feelings toward him? What are your feelings toward him?
I'm sorry he got to die a peaceful death, and I'm opposed to the death penalty. And I'm a real forgiving human being, and I hope he rots in hell. If there is a hell, I hope that's where he is. And I really have thought seriously of confronting Dee Maria face to face and saying why.
Despite Sandra Sue Attaway's eyewitness testimony, Charles Harrelson was found not guilty for the murder. And as a result, Frank Dee Maria was cleared of all charges.
They had no grounds to hold Dee Maria. No, he got off scot-free. He was arrested and out on bond, and then nothing.
I came into this trip to Texas thinking Charles Harrelson may have just been a con man, inflating his reputation to make some money and to intimidate. But after speaking with David and Linda Berg, I'm not so sure. What I have learned leads me to believe that Charles Harrelson was more than just a con man and a card shark. If Sandra Sue Attaway, the eyewitness, is to be believed, then he was a cold-blooded killer. But I still have some questions. First, how did his defense attorneys manage to get him off? Secondly, who was Harrelson really working for? Was he really just a freelance killer hired by a rival carpet salesman? Or was he doing collections for some larger organization? There's one man alive who must have some answers. Hi, is this Frank Dee Maria? Son of a Hitman is a Spotify original production, produced in partnership with Tradecraft Media and in association with High Five Content. The series is written and executive produced by me, Jason Cavanaugh. Our producer and editor is Alex Vespestead, and our associate producer is Deborah Correa. Additional editorial guidance provided by Natalie Robomed. Original music and theme song by Henry Benoit. Host supervisor is Blake Hill. Mixer is Tom Boykin. From Spotify Studios, executive producers are Liz Gately and Erica Clark, and senior producer is Christina Choi. From Tradecraft Media, executive producers are Ash Sarohia and Scott Bernstein. From High Five Content, executive producer is Andrew Jacobs. And many thanks to executive producer Brett Harrelson. Special thanks to Natalie Tella, Robin Hopkins, Jifa Yador, and Denise Holly. Thanks to Tegan Broadwater and Brad Thompson from Tactical Systems Network. Additional research for this episode is provided by David Berg's book, Run, Brother, Run. Charles Harrelson was found not guilty for the murder of Alan Berg by a jury of his peers, and the Brazoria County DA dismissed all charges against Frank Dee Maria. Frank Dee Maria has been given the opportunity to reply to the allegations contained in this episode. We'll cover his response in the following episode. Thanks for listening.